Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. For your information, Father Coughlin, the speaker of the evening, broadcasts three times each Sunday. Once at 3 o'clock in the afternoon for the East. Once at 4 o'clock for the children of Michigan and Ohio. And lastly at 8 o'clock for the Middle West and Far West. These three broadcasts are paid for at full commercial rates. And in no sense are they donated by the broadcasting corporations. They represent a weekly expenditure of more than $10,000. Never once has Father Coughlin this year asked the radio audience for a contribution, although these programs are supported by voluntary contributions. As is customary, Father Coughlin terminates his broadcasting activities shortly after Easter. This year will be no exception. Next Sunday will be his last appearance until next October. However, the Children's Hour will continue throughout the summer months. And now we present Father Coughlin.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. The theme of this evening's discourse might well be entitled 20 Years Ago. I have in mind a scene that was enacted in the capital of the United States 20 years ago, Tuesday of this week. As you know, the 6th of April, 20 years ago, fell on Good Friday. Those were days when the entire world found itself in the midst of the worst struggle which ever fell upon civilization. All of Europe was an armed camp. All of Europe was playing for America's participation in the World War. We had just elected a president who went into the White House on the theory that he had kept us out of war. We were feeling, as it were, more or less secure in our isolation across the Atlantic. Nevertheless, a barrage of propaganda was constantly being played upon our ears. Newspapers were carrying stories of the atrocities perpetrated by both the Central Powers and by the Allies. America was growing wealthy in those days because she was extending credit, millions of dollars of credit, billions of dollars of credit. She was manufacturing shells and shrapnel. She was dragging from the bowels of the earth the iron ore, transforming it into submarine steel. America was at the crossroads of prosperity. By 1915, our nation had become the financial agent of Great Britain and France. By 1916, it was evident that no longer could America stay out of the war simply because the Germans and her allies appeared to be on the side of victory. England and France, our creditors, appeared to be fighting a losing battle, and with their loss, it was very evident that the billions of dollars which we had extended to them would likewise be lost. About this time, Ambassador Page from London, England, had been communicating constantly with the capital in America. Ambassador Page, worrying more over the security of the private debts extended by privateers to Europe, was absolutely adamant in his decision that America must get into the war. At that time, there was much talk of saving the world for democracy. There was little speculation either in our pages of our papers or over the radio for us to save humanity. Little speculation for us to preserve democracy as we knew it in America. Nevertheless, Ambassador Page sent his last note from London, England, to President Wilson, absolutely demanding, as it were, that America cut all her endeavors at isolation and once and for all enter upon the side of the Allies to save not the world for democracy, but the billions of dollars which American privateers, I repeat, had invested in the war paraphernalia of Europe. I am taking you back tonight on the wings of fancy and of memory to the scene enacted in the Congress of the United States the Thursday of the Lord's Last Supper, the Thursday of the Good Friday which followed 1917. In the House of Representatives, a heated debate had ensued all day long. By a vast majority of votes, it was decided in that House to resolve that America should enter into war against the Central Powers. In the afternoon, the debate had entered upon the floor of the Senate chamber. I see still those old gray hairs, those waving plumes of the elder Robert La Follette. He, for one, believed in George Washington's admonition. He, for one, still believed that America should retain her independence and that America should stay clear entirely of all foreign entanglements. There was another gray-haired gentleman who stoutly held this same view, George Norris of Nebraska. He too cared not what those said to him in the Senate who had disagreed with him. They had called him traitor. They had inferred that he was not loyal and true to his country and to its best advantages. But what of that? Yes, he had a supporter. The Honorable James Reed of Missouri, with watch in hand, stood there gazing upon the clock in the Senate chamber. It was 10 minutes to 12 just before Good Friday. The debate had lasted all day long. Hot words had crossed the floor of the Senate. The word traitor, betrayer, the word painting the United States flag with a sign of the American dollar, such phrases had been cast, such phrases had been heard, and such phrases had excited the members of the Senate until James Reed, knowing that the cause was lost, stood up before his colleagues and said, "Gentlemen, do you realize what hour this is? Do you recognize what day this is? In 10 minutes, gentlemen, the hour hand of the clock will have struck the tolling hour of Good Friday. In 10 minutes, we will be celebrating the death of the Prince of Peace. And in 10 minutes, gentlemen, you must decide if you are determined that you will enter into war. You must decide before the celebration of the Prince of Peace shall be made a mockery of." Poor Honorable James Reed, silver-haired George Norris, the great Robert La Follette, they were defeated in that vote. And after the hour hand had crossed the mark of 12, when it was early in the morning, almost identical with the hour when Christ had been spending his lurid hours in the Garden of Gethsemane, the United States Senate, careless of the sacrifice made by the Prince of Peace, determined to project America and the flower of its youth into the fields of Flanders and alongside the gory banks of the Marne. Why was this? To keep America safe for democracy? Not at all. Why had this been perpetrated? To save a financial system that had been inadequate to save the world. Ladies and gentlemen, the thoughts of those hours spent in the United States Senate will never be erased from the minds of those of us who witnessed them. Those were the most tragic days, tragic hours in the history of this nation. So So came 1917 and 18. So fled from America more than 2 million young men, unprepared for battle. So crossed the Atlantic more than $50 billion American dollars for the progress of the war. At last Armistice Day came. At last the democratic people of America who had raised the loud hurrahs to heaven because our flag had been dipped in peace again raised the clamorous voices because victory had come, because we said the world had been made safe for democracy. Oh, see how foolish we democratic people were in that bygone day. Europe, from the Caspian Sea to the Mediterranean, has turned away from democracy, has lifted up one place the red flag of communism, has massacred its citizens in the name of liberty in Spain, has raised the tricolor of France for the honor and glory of socialism. Italy has gone, so has Germany. The world safe for democracy has become a world safe for radicalism, safe for dictatorship. And what of ourselves? 1918 came, so did 1920 with its panic. Some of you still remember, however, the glorious prosperity that was ours between 1921 and 1929. Those were the days when we had conceived the folly of lending more money to distracted Europe. 12 more billion dollars extended to Europe on American credit so that Europe could purchase from America the wherewithal to begin once more our passage through the streets of Jerusalem, up the steeps of Calvary, to be crucified under the aegis of dictatorship. At last it became evident in 1929 that all the monies which we advanced for the Great World War, that the billions which we had extended for recovery after the World War, would never be returned. I am not saying or inferring that these European nations were Welshers, a word that has been introduced into our vocabulary. But I am saying that after the World War, as well as before it, modern capitalism has been unable to sustain itself, and modern capitalism has been unable to preserve itself. Today, it lies dying on the threshold of tomorrow. Eventually came 1932. Those things were discussed. It was told that those debts that had been created abroad eventually would come home to rest their burden upon the shoulders of the American taxpayer. It was told that more than $50 billion of those debts could not be washed off with all the sound thinking, with all the logic of sound moneyism, or with all the politicians' favorism that could be brought to bear upon the contingency of the depression that was soon to fall upon it. Nevertheless, my friends, while we recognized in America in 1930 that there was little wrong with our country, while we recognized that its fields were just as fair, that its factories had been multiplied and were capable of producing everything to supply every feasible demand in America, while the ability of our engineers, executives, and the nimble fingers of our workmen were quite capable of producing untold wealth, nevertheless, by 1932, we came to that impasse of witnessing one-third of our population unemployed, the majority of our major production factories closed, our fields running into a riot with weeds, our citizens are running into a riot with radicalism, simply because there was no purchasing power. There was the wealth, I insist, but there was no available means of transferring wealth from one to the other. Then came March 4th, 1933. At that time, both you and I were thrilled to hear the mellifluous tongue of one pronouncing the words of driving the money changers from the temple. At that time, we stood almost in our second heaven as we thought the day had come when no longer the ordinary taxpayer would be forced to bear the burdens of finance for purposes of destruction. The day would come when we would be quite satisfied to bear the burdens for production. 1933 has melted into 1937. 1937 is here. So are the bonds that were issued to propagate the war of 1914-18. 1937 is here. So are the Liberty Bonds still here to haunt us. 1937 is here, and so are the ever-increasing debts created not out of the wealth of the country for purposes of production, but out of the borrowing power of the government from bankers whose institutions had been closed because their vaults were empty. Empty of everything, practically, save a bottle of ink and a fountain pen. And thus, with their fountain pens and their ink, they began writing out checks of billions of dollars. They began issuing these checks to the United States government with little or nothing to back them. The United States government, in turn, began to issue bonds to these bankers for those worthless checks. Bonds that contracted for you and for me to pay in real hard-earned money by the sweat of our brows not only their capital sum, but their interest, which today amounts well over $50 billion. The money changers were not driven out of the temple. And so, 1937 has come upon us. We are still struggling between the extremes of depression and the heights of prosperity. According to the Wall Street markets, we are almost on a par in our values of stocks and bonds to the day of 1916 and 1929. According to all reports, the productivity of our major factories has risen and risen until it is almost exceeding what was produced in 1929. According to all verified figures, nevertheless, while the rich can become richer, there are still 8 or 9 million unemployed in this nation. 1/3 of its population is still on the dole, and 2/3 of its population is still wondering where the cost of living can meet the purchasing power of the dollar. All you poor laborers and farmers, we have tried time and again to tell you that there can be no resurrection for America until Congress begins to coin and regulate the value of money. We have endeavored to teach you time and again that there can be no coming out of this depression until what you earn goes to sustain your wife and your children. But somehow or other you're satisfied to sustain the wives and children of those who do the coining and regulating of money, who live in their palaces and travel in their yachts. You want that, You voted for that. You have that. And it's time that you take that. Yes, America is troubled today because it well knows it has not emerged from the Depression. America is troubled today because it recognizes that there can be no recovery without reform. And America, in its solid hours of intellectual thought, realizes that the reform has not been forthcoming. The Federal Reserve banking system, unable to sustain its member banks in 1933, has been able to build up more than $20 billion of debt money for the United States government, which you will redeem out of your pay envelope, whether you like it or not. These are perilous days for America. We find our president, who had announced as late as last October and early November that America was well nigh out of the depression, we find our president today approaching the microphone crying crisis because he recognizes that he is unable to balance the budget, because he recognizes that the ordinary workmen in America are unable with their slender pay envelopes to meet the cost of living, to pay the invisible taxes, to bear the burden not only of their own families, but the burden of $50 billion of bonds at 3%, which must be paid for. Bonds that were for destructive purposes, not bonds that were for productive purposes. And in the meantime, the epidemic of sit-down strikeism has gone over America. Presidents are silent. Congresses are silent. While this industrial revolution bids fair to cause consternation to even the most level-minded men, where it will lead, no one knows. We do know this much, that it has gone far beyond the atmosphere of sit-downism as we knew in France. Today, at the Chrysler plant, we know in Detroit how 6,000 men marched in to take possession of it. Out they marched after a few hours, and 6,000 others, not owners of the factory, seized that property. Because they said there are no laws in America to protect human rights, while there are laws to protect financial rights. So then, what of democracy, as well as what of capitalism? Oh, capitalism shall never again flourish as once it did. Capitalism has been almost taxed out of existence in an effort to meet the coupons on the bonds, in an effort to meet the dole system that is absolutely unnecessary in a country of our wealth. And democracy? Oh, we who 20 years ago entered a war to fight its battles to make the world safe for democracy, tonight we stand aghast because its last fortification, its last tower of strength, the Supreme Court of America, who has been the protector of the rights of the poor, who has been the protector of the rights of the rich, who has been the protector of the liberties of all, is now assailed and is now the target for those who blame it for our misdemeanors and who blame it for the depression and the following misery which eventuated from it. Somebody must be blamed, of course. But those in power always forget to blame themselves. They always forget to read the Constitution of the United States of America
that says Congress has the power to issue and to regulate the value of money. And blinding their eyes to that as they protect the private issuance of money and the private fixation of money, we are going merrily on our way. Perhaps another ambassador from another foreign capital shall come upon the scene. Perhaps, despite the advice of Washington of no foreign entanglements, despite the passage of the Johnson Act, which forbids us to lend money to those who already have borrowed it and who have not returned their loans, perhaps despite those things, some way, some miraculous way shall be found to project America into the next maelstrom, and democracy, once more thinking that it has power within its soul, shall rise up to clap and applaud, because the youth of the land is going abroad to make the world safe for what? Safe for dictatorship? Safe against communism abroad when we have communism at home? Safe from socialism in France when we have socialism in America? Or safe? Safe for the international bankers. Next Sunday shall be my last Sunday until next October. And in the meantime, I ask you to think seriously of your decisions last November. You have asked for the New Deal that is an ancient deal in all its finance. You have what you asked for. I ask you to abide by your decision. You had been warned 1,000 times. Those who warned you should now bow their heads, even though truth be on their side. You have paid the price, democratic America, and now it is your turn to bear the burden in silence, like men, keeping America safe for democracy. Good evening. God bless you.
You have just listened to a broadcast address delivered by Father Charles Coughlin of Royal Oak, Michigan. Over these same stations, at this same hour, Father Coughlin will have the privilege of addressing you again next Sunday. Tonight, Father Coughlin spoke to you from the studios of CKLW, and his broadcast reached you over a special network.